LA has the largest jail system in the country.
You got people that have been in jail just like one time in their life, can't get nothing because of whatever mistake they made.
I stole some ground turkey because I wanted to feed my family. We was hungry.
Off the Block, stories tracing the path from city block to cell block and back. Available September 13th at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Independent Producer Project of KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is a program of true stories and personal documentaries. And today on the program, Live, Die, Kill, Los Angeles. And I'll say right up front that this episode has some very blunt discussions about death and dying. And you may want to keep that in mind if you're listening with children, say, or anyone who might be sensitive to that sort of thing. Plus, as you might hear in my voice, I have a cold. So, Karen Michelle is a longtime public radio producer. And when she came to Los Angeles for a visit, one place that was definitely on her itinerary was the Museum of Death.
Next to a nightclub slash titty bar, across from a used car lot, claustrophobic and smelly as befits a place of putrefaction.
That's Karen. The Museum of Death keeps things like artifacts from the Heaven's Gate mass suicide.
We don't believe that our Father's kingdom has much need for these flesh bodies.
Music performed by Charles Manson.
People say I'm no good.
And there's other stuff they call murderabilia. And the reason that Karen comes to a place like this is that she's more than just interested in death. She is a student of death. She thinks about death without taking things too seriously. She makes jokes about death, tries to learn from it, doesn't hide from it. And she talks to other people about death in a matter-of-fact way. Death is a natural part of just being human. And for many years now, she's been working on an occasional series of radio pieces and live performances that she calls Live, Die, Kill. Three questions in various geographies. What she does is she travels around the country and she talks to people about their answers to these three questions. What do you live for? What would you die for? And what would you kill for? So in 2010, Karen had the idea to do a radio project here in Los Angeles. It's the city where she spent most of her childhood. Well, the project ended up taking a long time to make, about 5 years. And in large part, it was because during this time, Karen's father, Marty, who was in his 90s, developed health problems and ultimately passed away. So when she was ready to start working again, this ended up being a very different project than the ones she's done before. This time, in this version of her series, Karen wasn't just going to study death or have interesting conversations about death, because now she had to live with it. From KCRW and KCRW.com, it's Unfictional and Live, Die, Kill, Los Angeles.
Here's something I've learned. Grief has no time limit, no expiration date. Whether it's for a person loved, place lived, an experience better left unhad. When I was 5, maybe 4 years old, living in a two-story greenish stucco apartment building just south of Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles, a neighbor girl just a few years older took me across the street to a bigger apartment in a bigger building. No one was home. I don't think she lived there. There was a little fish tank. Inside were two goldfish. We took one of the fish out of the tank, put it on the carpeted living room floor, placed a Kleenex over it, and watched as it arched its spine, flapped its tail side to side in a frantic fan dance, raised its head over and over until finally, terrified, I picked up the fish, feeling its thrashing gasps against my palm, and placed it back into its glass home, where it slowly went from the horizontality of near death to literally the swim of its life. I knew then that I had caused suffering, nearly killed. I've thought about death ever since. Recorded it, too.
My father stopped breathing. She wants to call 911. Yes, he's...
No, he's too late.
He's dead?
He's
living here. Carolina?
When my dad died, I was at home in slightly upstate New York. He, too, was home in his apartment in L.A. with his caregiver. My dad's death wasn't so long after his birthday. There'd been a little party for my Aunt Phyllis, who turned 84, and Marty, my dad, more than a dozen years her senior.
Tomorrow's your birthday.
Yes.
You're going to be how old?
I'll be 98.
And you've told me that I have no idea what it's like to be 98.
No, you don't, because you're not there.
Right, so tell me, what's it like?
Pardon?
What is it like?
You feel there's no tomorrow. It's all over with. You really do. And it seems like every week something else pops up unexpectedly that makes you even more down. And it gets more difficult to continue every day. And at 98, I feel I'm not going to make it to 99.
Yeah, but we went down the street to get a burrito. It was $10 for a burrito.
I have some
Marty burritos. No, I'm just saying, like, all the places I went near there was like,
good to see you.
Well, I mean, seriously, though, like a lot of people, they just,
what do you live for?
I live for my daughter. That's what I'm living for. She's what keeps me going. I'm happy for her. I'm very proud of her. And she keeps me going. I always look forward to her visits.
Her, that's me. In part, I'd recorded my father as part of a project I started shortly after 9/11. I was awakened that morning by the sound of the first plane hitting the Twin Towers, and soon knew that I was breathing the DNA of dead people. In response, some months later, my husband and I moved to the country. Lots of trees, no skyscrapers. And I started asking strangers, mostly, questions that for me distilled some of the essence of spiritual and political thought. What do you live for? What would you die for? And what would you kill for?
For those of you who are coming home to Los Angeles, we'd like to be the first to welcome you home. If you're just visiting our fair city, we ask that you please enjoy your time here.
Inevitably, those three questions took me back to Los Angeles, where I grew up as if one does, uprooted at the age of 2 1/2 from the enveloping branches in Manhattan's Grand Parks to the bewigged-looking palm trees of what became my L.A. youth. My parents often took me to the La Brea Tar Pits. It was free. Reeking of tar like a newly fixed street, huge ribs and tibia and the occasional mandible jutting out of the black ooze, and me always afraid I'd fall in and join the bones in their primeval pits. A fine place to ask strangers about life and death. Families still bring their kids to gawk. 9-year-old Dan Novak hadn't much thought about why he lived, wasn't into killing, and figured that if he died or when, there were potential benefits.
Well, I like imagine like you can do whatever what you want. I'm not sure, but that's what I imagine.
Oh, Alan Hancock had a tar pit, E-I-E-I-O. And in that tar pit he had a ground sloth, E-I-E-I-O. With a duh here and a duh there.
L.A. being a company town, there were plenty of performers around, some walking their dogs, others strutting themselves. Most days, Charlie Cox is at the Tar Pits. He makes his living as a busker there. Charlie claims Johnny Depp once gave him a $100 tip. Jodie Foster only gave him $2. For a performer, dying and killing have different professional meanings.
You killed an audience when you thrilled them to pieces.
Nobody's
right.
Applauding, you've died.
Right. So, yeah, I kill people all the time out here. I'm good. I'm good.
Oh, Alan Hancock had a tar pit, E-I-E-I-O. And in that tar pit, he had a camel, E-I-E-I-O, with a honk here and a honk there.
Next door to the tar pits, there's a repository of the work of dead and living artists, the L.A. County Museum of Art. Ed Moses, a painter, has work in that collection. Born in 1926, he's at home in a Venice compound that includes exhibits, studio, and living spaces, separate buildings, all of them both modest and grand, much like himself. Ed finds that weed and Tibetan Buddhism help him figure out what he lives for. And how?
That's an interesting question, because recently when I had this thing called temporal arteritis, I thought I was going to die. And I was so sick, my legs cramped up, my head was, I couldn't move. And I thought, my doctor said, we're going to have to put you in the hospital. I said, well, that's where you go to die. So if I'm going to die, why don't I just get my car and drive up to Mulholland and go off the edge there? Well, the reason I couldn't, because being a Buddhist, you can't take your own life, much less any other life. So I realized at that time there's this kind of little interval that you have, infinite time before, infinite time afterwards, and you get this little section of time. And it's precious. Being alive is precious. So focusing on the idea of being alive became sort of enriching. I sort of, wow, look at this. I really enjoy living. I enjoy the sky. I love driving my car, meeting people, having lunches, and painting particularly. Painting is the most, I can't wait every morning to start in painting.
Ed wouldn't kill, not an insect, nothing. As a Buddhist, it's not allowed. And though Buddhists accept death, always remember that they, we, will die, Ed's afraid.
I think the light goes out. I recently visited a friend, not too recent, and he was dead. And when somebody's dead, there's nothing happening. There's something uncanny about a dead person. I went up and shook him. He didn't move. I said, I'm glad you're dead, you rascal, you. He didn't move. He was lying in state in a studio. I felt guilty by saying such a thing. Conditioned to that kind of guilt. You can't say that. It's a taboo in our own conditioning. How's your tea?
Probably ready to drink.
My late mother, who took me with her to art museums and art galleries from the time I was tiny, really liked Ed's work. But up until he was in his early 90s, when he no longer could, my dad preferred spending time and money playing golf and going to restaurants with multiple tablecloths. Deep Tran's place doesn't have any, though she knows well the importance of family and food, both necessary for staying alive.
And we're here at my restaurant, Good Girl Dinette in Highland Park. I choose to call it Vietnamese comfort food. It's food that you usually get at home. You know, like your grandma, like a diner is like, it's meant for, you know, it's like your grandma's home cooking. And so I thought, well, what would it look like if the grandma was a Vietnamese woman that grew up in LA and that's a dyke, you know? And this is the food she'll give you.
Deep was raised by her grandparents in their restaurant, peeling shrimp, serving beer. She wasn't quite six when she moved from Vietnam to the U.S. Her mother was dead, her father in a concentration camp, where he spent 15 years.
Well, I guess what I live for is this, the feeling of being alive. You know, I don't really care about, of course, I'm a businesswoman, I want to be financially solvent, but I think it's like when I come into work and when, like, a recipe just turns out right, or, you know, even if I've made it, like, a million times, it's just, like, when it's just pitch perfect, it's just beautiful. I love that feeling of just kind of being connected to like that batch of curry or whatever. It's just that feeling of just being present, and that's kind of what I live for. And if that makes sense. Yeah, I think it's more about Vietnamese have more of a sense of survival than living or dying per se. You know, like you just do what it takes to survive and thrive, hopefully. but not, maybe not living and dying.
El muerto al hoyo y el vivo al pollo. The dead to the hole and the one alive eats the chicken.
The dead to the hole and the one alive eats the chicken.
Okay, it rhymes in Spanish, but that's life. Life continues, you know. They cry for you today. They want to jump on the hole with a casket, and a week later they forgot about you.
Augie, Augustine Garibay, is a mechanic at LA Mission College. On weekends, there's a farmer's market and food trucks, green apple frozen yogurt, tacos de pollo asado tasty enough to tempt a vegetarian. Augie likes it all. A vet and a Catholic, he also has alternative beliefs.
I have had few experiences that they are not normal. How could I call your spirit, your energy, can separate from your body and travel? I have encounters, places where I go, I sleep a couple times in a cemetery, and the only thing I saw at night, the rabbits and everything, nothing happened. I'm more afraid of a live person than a dead person. That person can do nothing to you. A life can hurt you if you put your guard down.
Pick your French philosopher, and you know that we're all playing roles, both as spectator and as the spectated. Wrestling and flea markets are especially great spectacle, as was this one not far from Mission College. Vendors sold fresh fruit juices, sunglasses, DVDs and CDs by popular artists with homemade-looking inserts, bras fit for the biggest of busted, purple knockoff Chuck Taylors, and of course, there were musicians of varying skill. In the back of the market, near a small stage, Los Románticos Bohemios were ready to play.
Quiero ser en tu vida algo más que un instante, algo más que una sombra.
Their leader, Tony Hernandez from Oaxaca, knew well that music truly could kill.
Look, I wouldn't lie to you. If you listen to the radio, many of the stations now talk about corridos, drugs, and death. When you listen to corridos and music of that kind, it's what you're listening to, and your children are listening. And when they see that you're happy listening to that, then for them it will seem so natural to kill. So, yes, of course, music kills. Yes, yes, of course.
Es que sí, 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 automático, claro que sí. Claro que sí.
Muchas gracias.
A la orden, muchísimas gracias. Nosotros somos
Románticos Bohemios.
Okay.
Across the way at the entrance to the fair, a clown in thick white and red makeup twisted balloons into inflated flowers. Boo Boo had quite the story.
Después de este payasito que usted ve, soy una persona gay, me lo quito, soy una persona gay.
Before you, you see a clown, but I'm also gay. A long time ago, I experienced an injustice and ended up in prison because of my ex-partner. She slit her wrists and she blamed me for it. I'm strong and also very violent.
It was in jail that Boo Boo found Nichiren Buddhism. Now she chants every day and hopes to make amends before she dies.
That's why I'm so sure that I will return as I am. For example, right now I'm in a female body, but my inner self is male. Therefore, I would return as the warrior that I am.
I wear 8 rings. Among them are 3 that belong to dead women who were very, very close to me. My mother, my Tai Chi teacher, and Zora Pinney. As I do now, she always wore the silver ring with a yin-yang symbol that she'd bought as a young woman.
I just want to be with my son and with my husband.
Zora Pinney.
So you think dying is a way to be with them?
Yeah.
Why do you think that?
I don't know. But apparently I do. Because I tell them quite frequently that I'm very angry that they don't help me.
What do you mean they don't help you?
They don't help me commit suicide. I think of that frequently when I go to bed at night. I think, wouldn't it be nice if I just didn't wake up? That's the easy way. But so far, it hasn't worked.
Zora ran an art gallery, framing, and art supply store with her husband, Edward. Well before he died, Zora's then teenage son was killed in a motorcycle accident. He was the first person near my age I knew who had died. The Pinney's ramshackle shop and gallery was just 2 blocks from my parents' apartment. Zora became the mother I needed, who let a barefoot teenager sit on the floor of the gallery playing guitar, invited me to dinner with artists, and showed me that, in the scheme of things, dust bunnies didn't matter. Now in her 90s, she was ready to go, as she did a few months later.
I've thought about overdosing, but I don't know what pills to take, really. I imagine that there are some heart medications that I could overdose on, but I don't know that, I don't know what the results would be.
So why do you think that it's, that you want to go? I mean, have you had enough? It's just too much trouble? You're suffering?
No, I'm not suffering.
What do you think happens when you die?
I don't know, except that I think that I would be able to be closer to them. I'd be in the same place that they are. They're gone, and I'd be gone.
So you think when somebody's dead, that's it, kaput, over, out?
Yeah, that's logical.
Unlike Zora, old, alert, and still smoking cigarettes and drinking red wine, there are those folks who just don't want to go.
I'm Danny Hillis, and we're here at Applied Minds, which is a company that I founded, and I invent things.
Rocket engines, driverless cars, blood tests for diagnosing disease. Part of Danny Hillis's job leading a do tank involves killing. Ideas. This is a guy who is always thinking about the future, say as much as 10,000 years ahead, what he calls the long now. He's thinking about the long hereafter, too.
What's important to me is not so much my body living, it's my mind living. And so, for example, if you gave me the chance to download my consciousness into some mechanical, some computer or something like that, so that I still got to think and still got to sense the environment and have effect on the environment, even if it was through robot arms or something like that. I would certainly want to live like that. I mean, I like my body. I'd prefer to live like this. But if I had the choice between living inside a machine as a sort of disembodied consciousness and not living at all, I'd certainly pick the living inside the machine. No doubt about it, in a moment. And in fact, if you told me that I could live for 1,000 years inside a machine by giving up my body right now, and I believed you, I'd probably take the deal.
My dad wasn't into living even 100 years. A Jewish World War II vet, he spent time in and out and back into the VA hospital, and occasionally in what they call their home for heroes, a deceptively named place to dump the dying. The West LA VA's rabbi, Barbara Speier, always checked on my dad, called to tell me how he was doing.
Well, in Judaism, we believe in a ruach, a nefesh, and a neshama. The ruach is the breath of life which we have within us as long as we're alive. And when we pass away, that leaves us. And the nefesh is our soul or our persona. And the neshama comes from the word to breathe. And it's the spirit that we do believe lives on into eternity. So I just feel there's something else beyond which we don't understand, but we do believe in the spirits and we do believe in resurrection.
But there's a catch. There's a Messiah and a way for him, to know if he'll be among the eternal.
So we have a custom that every Jewish person who is buried in the diaspora has a little satchel of earth from Israel in the casket, so the Messiah will be able to identify all those who have to be resurrected.
Hi, Dad. You were right here. This dirt I'm touching right now is where I put your ashes.
When I buried my dad's ashes, bad enough as a Jew that he was cremated, Rabbi Barbara offered me some of that dirt. I didn't think my dad would want that, so instead I added some pot to the ashes. A little hit always helped his appetite, kept him going. So I thought, maybe indefinitely?
Hi, Dad. Oh my gosh, you're cold. Oh. It looks like you. It's you.
Now, Marty Michel shares space in a memorial park with his wife, my mother, Ellen. Marilyn Monroe, Natalie Wood, Dean Martin, Peggy Lee, and all sorts of showbiz folk, and a few fortune tellers, too. It's fitting for a man who used to keep a picture on his desk of himself with Jane Mansfield. My equally well-endowed brunette mother didn't like it at all. The day she died, long before he did, I asked my dad what he wanted now. To get laid, he said. L'chaim, to life indeed.
Well, I think that's about all I can say for the moment.
Thank you, Dad.
You're very welcome.
I think about death every day. It's essential to my spiritual practice, to be prepared for a good transition, a fearless passage. So I'm pretty comfortable with asking people about what they would live, die, and kill for. Over the few years of watching my father die, slowly, reluctantly, I got a few lessons about a good life, a good end. Watch wrestling on TV, hang out with younger people, keep drinking, and always look for adventure and love, even if it's just in your memories.
Live, Die, Kill, Los Angeles was produced by Karen Michel. Story editing and sound mix by me, Bob Carlson. Vital production help from Karen Soriano Nesbitt and technical assistance from Jennifer Swadek. Special thanks to Sarah Spitz, Chuck and Minna Taylor, Bob Vai, and Yomo the Dog Therapist. And you should know that earlier this year, that piece was a gold medal winner at the New York Festival's Best Radio Programs for 2016. You can find photos and other information about this episode at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. While you're there, you can find an archive of all the past episodes of this program. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The editor is Nick White. The associate producer is Carla Green. You can podcast the program on iTunes, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, however you like to hear podcasts. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Unfictional or like us on Facebook. If you do like the program, please leave a nice review about it on iTunes. It'll help more people find the show. But most importantly, I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional on kcrw.com.